UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where your hosts go through movies, remakes, and sequels. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is my ever-constant co-host, Zach, pay attention. Kate, can you look over here? Stop looking at the lady in the red dress, okay? Pay attention here, eyes front. We got to talk about a podcast today.
What good is a microphone when one is unable to speak?
Ooh, nice reference.
Agent Smith, that's from this movie. That's why I said it.
It is. That's nice. Well, we've got ourselves a special guest. If you've listened in our feed or whatnot, we recently did the Halloween Kills episode for the Talk Film Society. And while we were talking about that, Marcelo's like, I love The Matrix and the sequels. So we have Marcelo J. Pico joining us for this one for sure. Hopefully at least one of the sequels, if not all three of them. We'll get him on for these to discuss them. Marcelo, thank you for joining us. I'm sorry we had to interrupt you. I know that's a beautiful looking steak you're eating there. I mean, I know it's not real, but man, it looks so juicy.
Hey, but it tastes real, okay? That's the only thing that matters here. And thanks for having me on here because, hey, as I'll say throughout, you know, hopefully for a majority of the series, I love these movies, especially this first one. But yeah, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, after all this time, going back to where it all started. Back to The Matrix.
Yeah, The Matrix.
I love that trailer. I love that trailer. And that's why we're talking about The Matrix trilogy, by the way, because this is building up to the fourth one. So this is all, we planned it all, just like The Matrix itself. We're all planned out perfectly, aren't we, Brandon?
We are absolutely planned out. We had this planned from the beginning. We knew this was coming. We talked to the Wachowskis, and so we had our schedule all planned out. It was perfect. So... excellent. Right on. But before we get into our discussion in the trivia here, I did want to let everybody know that we do have a new website. It's called whatisthefranchisefatigue.com. And the password to get into that is steak.
So, has anybody tried that recently? Whatisthematrix.com?
No. I think they brought it back. Yeah, they brought it back for the Matrix 4. They had, for that trailer, they had all these alternate, like, micro variations in them, as I understand it. So,
I now remember I spent a day of my life on that website when that recently because they brought it back for that new trailer. So right. Yes, yeah,
that's funny. I've never been to the website. You know, the only promotional thing like that I ever really participated in was for Snakes on a Plane.
What?
You could go to this website and submit a phone number. And you would get, like, this voicemail from Samuel L. Jackson telling you to go see Snakes on a Plane.
Wow.
Wow.
And it was, like, it was awesome. It was a pretty awesome little promotion that they had.
Not to jump ahead, but, like, a big complaint I had with, like, The Matrix Resurrections is, like, oh, Warner Brothers isn't promoting this enough. Like, not like the two sequels in 2003 when they had a video game, they had the Animatrix, they had all of these, like, trailers, you know, priming everybody for these two sequels in the same year. And I'm like, where's the love for Resurrections? And then they had that website, they had the new trailer, they had these alternate trailers online. And yeah, I'm hyped at this point for Resurrections. Like, I'm also glad I'm here to hype that too, because that's one of my most anticipated of the year. So in terms of getting you ready in promotion for a movie, The Matrix franchise knows what it's doing.
Absolutely, man. I was not a fan of the two sequels. Right? I'm one of these guys who's like, you know what? Movies that should never had a sequel. You know what's at the top of that list? The Matrix. Well, you know, we'll talk through it, right?
Oh,
but seeing this trailer, so hyped. I'm so in. And I always said if they made a fourth Matrix movie, it had to be called Resurrections. And they're doing it. And I really think that's one of the best trailers like I have seen, because it's playing into the mythology of the movie, using the song, like bringing you back. Like, I don't know, back to the Matrix. I don't know. So I'm riding the hype train as well. And I'm hoping after all this time revisiting the sequels, I'll kind of have a fresh perspective on it, because it really has been a long time since I've seen them. So, because I'm a big Matrix fan myself as well. So, what about you, Brandon? Are you plugged in or not?
Well, okay, so I remember when I went and saw the first Matrix. I saw it in theaters back in 99, and I remember the theater, it doesn't exist anymore. It's now like a dollar store. It's like in the basement of our mall downtown in here in Regina. And I went and saw the movie, and everybody was hyped for it, and I walked out of the theater, and I'm like, it was nothing special. I don't know. I didn't really like it. And I didn't watch it again for a couple of years, and then I watched it again on home video, and I'm like, okay, I took a pretty sharp turnaround on it and really enjoyed it. But then I don't think I knew that there was sequels coming for it. So when I didn't expect there to be sequels to this movie. And so when the sequels were announced, I'm like, that's pretty weird. And I saw the other two in theaters as well. And I really enjoyed the second one. I mean, that freeway chase sequence, man, I freaking love that. I think that's amazing. And I kind of felt let down with the last one. And I didn't watch them again for a while, and then I have them on HD DVD, and so I watched them
finally on HD DVD. There it is.
A few years ago,
the way to go.
I got the box set. And I don't know. I guess it was about 5 years ago or something like that. I finally watched them again on HD DVD. I'm like, yeah, these are pretty good. So this is like really going to be my, I don't know, maybe fourth time watching all of them. Like when we go through them this time. So I'm like, I'm not a huge fan. And then I was very surprised to hear there's a fourth one coming out. And I've only watched the trailer once. I mean, I'm excited. My wife's more
only excited once,
than I
Brandon.
Am.
I've watched that trailer like 25 times. I'm not even kidding. Like I really rarely get so hyped about trailers and stuff. But I, for whatever reason, that tapped into something from like the early 2000s for me, which I'm like, ooh. I'm picking up what they're putting down. So I'm super hyped. So.
Excellent. Yeah, I never played the video game or anything like that.
Enter the Matrix.
And I didn't play that, and I haven't actually seen the Animatrix, but I am going to watch it. We're not going to talk about it for this, but I am going to finally watch it for
everything
this,
is in continuity. Even the Matrix Online video game, which, spoilers, kills off Morpheus, which may or may not be why Lawrence Fishburne is not announced yet to be in the fourth one. I'm holding out hope that he's going to be some kind of reveal, some kind of secret they're hiding for the fans, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much I want to reveal about what's been said about Resurrections, but yeah, it's interesting that Lawrence Fishburne said recently, like, he wasn't asked to be back, so we'll see what happens with that. But I mean, I might be, so I guess I am the biggest Matrix fan, you know, on the show right now. Because,
of the three, yeah.
Of you guys, because, like, I loved it from the start. I didn't see this in theaters initially. Too young, but I saw it on DVD, loved it. I did have a chance to see it theatrically on 35mm. The trilogy, they screened it here in 35mm at the Draft House in Austin a few years back. I mean, at that point, I was already a huge fan of the first and the second and third movies. And then I saw the first one again in Dolby Cinema about 2 years ago when they screened that again. Loved it still. So it's the Matrix trilogy is one that I've seen many times, and each time I see them all, I love them even more. So yeah, I'm the biggest fan. I played Enter the Matrix video game. I did see the Animatrix. Like, yeah. I was totally on board. I was the right age for the Matrix sequels in 2003. I was like 17 years old. I was that kid.
I was just a little bit younger than you. I have a story that I'll save for the next episode about when I first saw Matrix Reloaded. But I saw the first movie a little bit on cable, and then eventually, like, I think I started watching like the climax, and my dad was like, you know what, let's turn it off, and then you need to see this from the beginning. And then eventually I saw it on DVD and was hooked, and then I was like so hyped for the Matrix Reloaded. I'm like, this is our Star Wars, you know, our generation, you know, that everybody really was saying that was the talk back then, you know. But the Matrix trilogy is the new Star Wars trilogy, ironically going concurrently with a new Star Wars trilogy at the time. So the early 2000s is such a unique time, and the Matrix represents so much of it, and that's why it's so fun to revisit.
And we can say now that it was the new Star Wars. End of discussion.
Everything was the new Star Wars back in the 90s. I remember when Fifth Element was the new Star Wars. Back right. In
the Mummy was the new Star Wars.
That's right, yes. So Golden Girls, the movie, that was the new Star Wars too. I'm pretty sure they advertised it like that. So. Okay, so this one here, so Matrix Resurrections, is this the one where they clone Neo to get the mechanical thing out of his belly?
That's right, because as we all know, Neo sacrificed himself at the end of Matrix 3, jumping into a vat of lava because he had a queen in his insides. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
Why do you keep bringing up Alien 3? Is that
awesome? I love Alien 3.
I can also talk Alien 3. I can heap praise on that. I love that movie, too.
I love Alien 3. But why don't we jump into our discussion here? Zach, you got a little bit of trivia on the Matrix?
Yeah, back to the Matrix.
Enter the Matrix.
Now, the Matrix. The idea for the movie was created when the Wachowskis were thinking of a new story for a comic book series, and they wrote an entire script before their first directorial debut, which was Bound, which has come out in 1996. And they worked on the script for The Matrix up until the time of its production. They had draft after draft after draft. Now, producer Joel Silver actually optioned their screenplay for The Matrix even before they made Bound, which that became their kind of claim to fame, but obviously before The Matrix. And their first choice for Neo, now remember the writing is in the late 90s, mid-90s, I should say. Their first choice for Neo was Brandon Lee, but he had died tragically on the set of The Crow. So they're like, well, can't cast him. So who do you cast? You cast the Fresh Prince himself, Will Smith. Now, this is a famous Hollywood story. Will Smith has even done a video kind of making fun of himself about it as well. Will Smith was approached to play Neo, and the Wachowskis met with him, and he was like, he just didn't get it, didn't connect with him. And he didn't think, now he looks back, he's like, you know what, I wasn't mature enough of an actor to do that, and I would have messed it up. This is what has Will Smith today says about himself. But he just didn't really get the pitch and all that, so what he ended up doing is he turned down The Matrix, and he did Wild Wild West that came out the same year. So that is an infamous what-if in Hollywood history. Because I think, and we'll talk about this, but I think this is one of the most perfectly cast movies like in movie history right here. Everybody plays their part perfectly and is perfect for it, plays to the strengths of all these actors. I love Will Smith, but I don't think he would have been a good fit, and I think he's right. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Keanu Reeves is pretty good in this, but I think it would have been a little better if they cast Jack Nicholson.
Okay.
Would you say that for any movie? No, you see that I'm glad you brought that up with the Will Smith thing. Like, I think now things have turned out great for both Will Smith and Keanu Reeves because of the choices they made. It would have been weird to it's a win-win. Like, Will Smith might win an Oscar later this year for King Richard, and Keanu Reeves has like a new resurgence because of the John Wick series, and then that has to do with him being the Matrix movie. So yeah, it's a win-win for everybody.
So Wild Wild West is the direct link to Richard.
Yeah, King Richard. Yeah, because of Wild Wild West, we're getting King Richard this year.
Now, the Wachowskis worked on this for years, and like I said, they had like 14 drafts of the screenplay, and most of the executives, they loved the ideas, but they just could, studio executives they pitched to, they loved the ideas, but they just couldn't wrap their head around like what it would look like on screen. So they hired illustrators Steve Scorsese and Jeffrey Darrow, and they made hundreds of storyboards for The Matrix, and then after they made those storyboards, it sold immediately. They really loved what they saw, and they picked up what they were putting down. But they had to film it in Australia, and they kept the final budget $60 million because if they had it was greenlit by Warner Brothers, by the way, Warner Brothers. And had they filmed it in the U.S., it would have been $180 million. So that is three times as much. So that's why everybody's filming in Australia. This launched a lot of Australian productions, right? Because this was the first film to be shot in the Fox Studios in Sydney. And they filmed, Superman Returns, all kinds of The Matrix sequels, all kinds of big blockbusters came from The Matrix starting off down there in Australia. Now, talk about Will Smith, some other actors who were circling Neo. John Cusack apparently lobbied hard for the role. I could see that. He's like a more quieter, I don't know. He's in the same shade as Keanu Reeves, you know what I'm saying? So... I could see him as Neo. Brad Pitt turned it down. Apparently, he just didn't think it was a good fit for him. Lots of other names, but these are a couple names that I circled that connected both the lead roles. Apparently, David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson both turned down Neo in Trinity. I don't know if that was together or independently. I don't know exactly where that rumor comes from. I want to think they had the good sense to approach them separately, because why would you just cast... the cast of the X-Files, right? X-Files. And Mitch Pileggi is
Maybe they had the Matrix. Maybe they had the Matrix with the X from the X-Files on it, and it would be like an X-Files spinoff, right? Like,
maybe so.
Off of the... What was that seventh season episode, First Person Shooter? Like,
And remind me, Fight the Future came out in 98, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That mm-hmm. would have been wild a year later to see both of them star in The Matrix.
I love both of them as actors, but that was a good choice. Like, you can only, there's going to be so much cross-pollination between all these franchises, and so that's fine. I'm glad they turned it down and went on to do their own things. Now, speaking of Trinity and Will Smith, Jada Pinkett Smith auditioned for the part of Trinity, didn't get it, but then she went on to play Niobe in the sequels. And that is after Aaliyah was cast as that role, and then she unfortunately died tragically before she could play Niobe. So anyway, that's
yes,
just so many connective tissues between all these roles and actors and parts here. Now, Carrie Ann Moss, I didn't know this until looking up trivia for this podcast. She was in a short-lived TV show in 1993 called Matrix. So, again,
I had no idea.
It's all connected. Now, she performed all the shots of Trinity at the beginning of the film and all the wire stunts throughout herself. She twisted her ankle during the production, shooting one of the scenes, but didn't tell anyone because they didn't want them to fire her and recast her, right? Because you've heard horror stories about that. Think about Sean Young on Batman, right? She's training to ride that horse for a deleted scene. Right? Sean Young falls off a horse, breaks a collarbone. The recaster for Kim Basinger. Sean Young just never hit the same height she was in the 80s after that. So, and that's a big tragedy of that is, like I said, you ask yourself, when was Vicki Vale, that's who she's cast as in Batman, riding horse in Batman? Wasn't. Deleted that scene. So, anyway, Carrie Ann Moss also said that after The Matrix came out, she could not go outside wearing sunglasses because that would make people instantly recognize her. So it's funny because usually people use those as a disguise, you know. But for her, it's like if you're in The Matrix, like the sunglasses, that's going to tie one and two together for people. So she couldn't wear sunglasses anymore for a while. Now, speaking of the Will Smith rumor, there's other discussions, and this rumor has generated and circulated and grown over the years, that Sean Connery was in talks to play Morpheus. He was actually in talks to play the architect in the sequel, not Morpheus. This is according to Will Smith, they were looking at Val Kilmer for Morpheus at the time. Again, lots of casting ideas about this. So, but hey, Sean Connery, talking about turning stuff down, right? He turned on the architect, he also turned down Gandalf. And Lord of the Rings, which was the right call. As much as I love Sean Connery, Ian McKellen is perfect as Gandalf. So, again, early 2000s, man. What a time for cinema. Russell Crowe also turned down the role of Morpheus. He said, quote, "I just didn't get it. I couldn't get past page 42. That role was just not interesting to me." And what's funny is Lawrence Fishburne, who they eventually did cast, he didn't think it was complicated at all. He didn't understand why people found it confusing, but he had his doubts if it would ever get made because it was so smart, in his opinion. So he got it, right? So that's why they cast him. Now, Agent Smith, who I think is one of the greatest villains in cinema, I think he's fantastic. Of course, Hugo Weaving played him, and he was cast on the strength of his performance in a movie called Proof from 1991 that the Wachowskis really liked. I'll have to go seek this out because I really love Hugo Weaving. I've never heard of this movie before. But there were some other actors in the running or in consideration. Christopher Maloney from Law and Order and Man of Steel, probably for the most mainstream people. But Law and Order, I mean, come on, it's ran for 20 years. Everybody knows Stabler, who's back, by the way, in his own show on NBC. He auditioned for Agent Smith. I could see him as Agent Smith. Gene Reno was also approached for Agent Smith, but he turned it down to appear in Godzilla. So similar to Will Smith, you bet on the wrong horse there.
And hey, his career turned out just fine too, right?
I mean,
Now I'm thinking about it. Maybe not.
Trying to think after. Was he in Rat Race? I'm trying to think of other movies that he was in after this. But anyway, but I love Gene Reno. He's fantastic. He's the best part of Godzilla.
I love the guy.
He will always be Le Professional. So anyway.
But imagine Jean Reno in Hannibal, the TV show, instead of Lawrence Fishburne. Oh,
man. I could see that.
No, I don't want to imagine that.
Speaking of Christopher Maloney, Man of Steel, Lawrence Fishburne is Perry White in the DCEU, who I think he's a great Perry White, by the way. Just throwing that out there as a Superman fan, as you guys know I am. But anyway, final thing on Agent Smith for now. Hugo Weaving, he tried to emulate a 1950s news broadcaster for his voice. And he said it was very helpful for him to kind of get a neutral voice because obviously he's Australian and he was kind of have a more neutral tone to his voice because he didn't want to sound like he was from somewhere, but he didn't want to sound a robot. So he spent a long time, and I think that's why all his lines and his cadence are so memorable and people love quoting it so much, because of the way he talks so deliberately. But anyway.
In the in-movie experience, I watched that today, they said Walter Cronkite is who he bases
on. There you go. Yeah. And that's the way it was. Now, Belinda McClory auditioned for Switch, and she was originally only going to have half of that role. That character was originally going to be a male in the real world and a female in the Matrix. So that's why the name was Switch. Get it? And knowing the Wachowskis, right? Went from male to female. I mean, there's so many of those undertones here, and so that totally makes sense. But they ended up, and I'm not sure if this was like studio interference or who knows, right? But they eventually just made her Switch both in the Matrix and in the real world. So that would have been a very interesting component. And I feel like in the Matrix Resurrections, we're going to see more of that. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I really wish they would have done that, because nowadays people who misinterpret the Matrix would think otherwise, that yes, folks, there is a trans allegory in this.
My name is Neo. I mean, come on, it's all there. Exactly. But I mean, and we'll talk about it, right? But there's so much you could bring, like you bring so much of it to the canvas of the Matrix. That's the brilliance of it, right? There's so much of that there. But to say things like that aren't there, or just you're just being blind to it. But I mean, look at the creators. But anyway, we'll stick to the trivia for now, right? Now
they did mention that in the end movie experience as well, that they were told not to do it because they thought it'd be too confusing for the viewers to have the gender swap of a character.
Too confusing.
From one reality to the other.
We'll go with that. So, legendary Hong Kong stunt coordinator Wu Ping-Yin initially refused to work on the film. He got the script, which he liked, but he asked for a crazy fee, and he wanted complete control over all the stunts, because he thought they would say, okay, never mind. But they said yes. So he trained the actors with his own team for 4 months prior to shooting. So that's why you're able to, and it's so great, because obviously there are stunt doubles, but so many of the main actors do so many of their own stunts in this, and it really shows. Now, the opening action scene, it took 6 months of training for that, and it only took 4 days to shoot. So 6 months for four, it's like preparing a nice meal for dinner, right? 7 hours of preparation, eat it for 20 minutes. But, and then after the lobby shootout, right, when the camera pulls back and it shows the aftermath and all the bullet holes and all that, that pillar that falls over, that was not planned, but they left that in just for effect. Wow. I think that's fantastic. I'm glad they kept rolling. Imagine if they had cut. It would have missed such a great opportunity there. And the climactic subway fight scene between Neo and Agent Smith, that went 10 days over schedule. Wow. So, but it was totally worth it, I think. So, now, there's a lot of talk about who invented the bullet time effect, as it's been called. Many names have been floated around. There was kind of a team effort, but Michael Gondry, who used it for the first time in a commercial and then in a video clip for Bjork. Also, Matthew Bannister, who suggested motion and time and video could be separated, and proposed the apparatus for doing it much like the one that was used in the film. And also Tim McMillan, who demonstrated the technique on British TV way back in 1993. It could have been all of them. It could have been others. It could have been invented independently. But there's just a lot of discussion about this. Also, visual effects supervisor John Gaeta and director of photography Bill Pope, who did the work on the film itself, they constructed a lot of gimbals and dollies, and they wanted to create the look the old-fashioned way. But after many failed tests with dollies, because they just keep flying off and they just couldn't do it right, they did computer graphics, which meant an entirely new effect. But the bullet time effect does still use very old-fashioned technique, still photography. Like, and I think, if you're listening to podcasts like this, you're into movies, you've seen enough behind-the-scenes features to kind of know how they did it, but still, even to this day, I think it's very impressive.
And I should also say there have been people on Twitter who also point out, hey, what about the movie Lost in Space that came out, a year or two before? That also had, the bullet time.
Yeah, 1998. Yeah, Lost in Space, yeah.
98, yeah.
I saw that in the theater.
I did too.
I've never seen that one.
Don't bother,
you're okay.
Brandon. I've never seen that one. Don't bother. Now, the green code that makes up the Matrix, that was created by the production designer scanning his wife's sushi recipes from a cookbook. So that's why you have numbers, backwards letters, and then characters like that. So that's why it has that unique look to it with all the letters. You're like, what is it? Letters, numbers? It's a combination of all those different things. People talk about, you know, movies that were either came out concurrently with The Matrix or might have borrowed from it or The Matrix borrowed from them. Dark City, Equilibrium, right? All came out around the same time. What's interesting here is that they actually use sets from Dark City in The Matrix in the opening rooftop chase. Mm-hmm. Those are the same rooftops from Dark City. But the screenplay for The Matrix, again, it had been written years and years before Dark City, which is an interesting movie. I recommend everybody go check it out. Rufus Sewell, who I love from A Knight's Tale, and he's in lots of other stuff, but that's my go-to for Rufus Sewell. Also Old by M. Night Shyamalan. Rufus Sewell showed up in that. And Man in the High Castle. But anyway, we're not here to talk about that. There's only one Dark City. There's not a franchise of those. Now, a lot of iconography in this movie, like the phones, right? The spring-loaded cell phones, which are so cool. Like, if they still had these, I would go get them. But those were Nokia Stilettos, also known as 8110s. So if you're curious to go on eBay and get yourself some Matrix phones and make a Matrix fan film, there you go. Get some photos, do some bullet time, and use your phone. Also, you might want to get a 1965 Lincoln Continental, because that is the car that they use when they're driving around inside the Matrix. Now, for the scene where Neo wakes up in his pod in the real world, Keanu Reeves lost 15 pounds and shaved his whole body to give Neo a kind of an emaciated look. The last scene shot in the film was Neo getting flushed out when he gets unplugged for the first time. So they're doing that whole, like, okay, you have to look different here, so we're going to film it at a different time of the year than we film the other stuff. It's the magic of movies, man. So... Mm-hmm. Now, the only other character that we know his real world name, or I'm sorry, his Matrix name, is Cypher, because Agent Smith, when he meets with him, he calls him Mr. Reagan. So I thought that was interesting. Also, he wants to be an actor. Who else was an actor? Ronald Reagan. Ooh. Is that intentional? I don't know. But that's the thing about the Matrix, man. There's so many levels to everything, you don't know.
Ronald Reagan, the actor.
Who's the vice president? Jerry Lewis. Anyway,
it's a reference to another great trilogy.
Yes. Oh boy, that's you know, we were talking about on the Halloween podcast. The more we talk, the more we're just going to reference other franchises we've covered on this podcast. So a couple last things here. When does The Matrix takes place? Well, in the movie, Morpheus even says this. You think it's 1999? It's actually more like 2199. So that's when it takes place in the real world. But when is the world of the Matrix takes place here? Well, it's bookended by these two phone calls that the machines are trying to trace. There's timestamps on it. The first phone call is February 19th, 1998, and the last phone call is September 18th, 1999. So that means the events of this film take place over the course of 19 months. Now, not only was The Matrix extremely successful, but it was also very critically acclaimed. It won 4 Academy Awards. It was nominated for 4, and it won all 4. And that is the best sweep by anything not nominated for Best Picture. It also won Best Editing that year at the Oscars, and it was the only film that was nominated for Best Editing that was not nominated for Best Picture. So I love it when the genre can break through. This is a pre-Lord of the Rings world, right? So the genre film's breaking through. I love that. I love to see that. And they deserved it. I mean, special effects, come on. Game changer of this movie.
I mean, really, it was a packed year in terms of quality of movies in 99, but I can for sure say The Matrix should have won Best Picture over what won Best Picture in 99, which, if memory serves, was American Beauty.
Oh.
Right. I think you're right.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good one. But...
You know,
we should do, Marcello? We should expand the nominees to 10, and then I think we won't have this problem anymore.
Oh, yeah. I like that idea. And we should do that just for like 3 or 4 years and then forget it.
Yeah.
And then just do like varying numbers after that.
You know, we should do it for one particular movie who didn't get nominated and then hope that its sequel will get nominated and then have that sequel not even get nominated. That's what we should do. What are we talking about? Just go look it up. You guys know. But
it's another trilogy.
Another trilogy. Last thing here, for the Ultimate Matrix Collection DVD. The first film was given a totally clean new look, replaced the grainy transfer that had been on the DVD since 1999, and also recolor timed it to be more in line with the green tinted sequels, which, I don't know, maybe you guys can sell me on that. I still kind of prefer the original color timing of the film, which is more bluish.
So if I can jump in, I have things to say about this because this is very controversial. I've done my research on this part, at least. When they first released that box set, yes, they color timed it to make it more green. This is for, I believe, the DVD. I'm not going to walk over and grab them, but I have all these box sets. So the first DVD box set of The Matrix, this like pristine collector's edition, yes, they color timed it to change the first movie's look. When they're in The Matrix, they made it more green. When they're outside The Matrix, it's more blue. But then when they transferred it to 4K, they went back and undid some of that green tinting, some of that color timing to make it more natural to what it was in 99. So when you see it on 4K, or I think the HBO Max version is also timed, quote-unquote correctly, they take that green tint away now. So yeah, it's gone through its own sort of like controversy in terms of color timing. Same with Lord of the Rings recently. They had their own sort of issues with like color correction and, putting too much color in certain scenes. But I think the recent 4K releases of that try to correct that. So yeah, so if you have the 4K editions of The Matrix, those look more natural than if you have any previous versions. I think the DVDs and like the early Blu-ray copies have that much higher green tint and blue tint than these new versions.
You know, while we're talking about this and talking about other franchises, Marcelo, what do you think about the new Batman 4K transfers? Because I hate the blue color tint, especially on Batman 89 and Batman Returns.
Oh, see, I don't mind them. They're honestly not as bad as like other releases that color time. But I see where you're coming from. I'm totally okay with like the color timing of the 89 and Returns.
I'm just gonna hold on to my original Blu-ray releases for those.
That's the thing. So. See, and also I also have the original box sets.
So yeah,
of those
you're fine.
Batman movies. So anyway. I'm good. Yeah, yeah.
So is like color timing the new? What they did with Predator when they like scrubbed out all the digital noise in the movie, is that like the new thing, the new way to mess up a movie?
Yeah, it happens. The two biggest examples of that are the ones I just mentioned, like The Matrix and Lord of the Rings. So those are the big ones I know that are steeped in controversy in the. Because I'm in these forums, guys. Unfortunately,
In these. I knew you'd have an opinion about that.
Because this is the stupid things I follow, but yeah. Those two are the biggest examples of that. And I know we're talking about with the Predator, too, because sometimes these releases, and I'm looking at you, Terminator 2, some of these releases don't get, you know, the timing, the, you know, color correction, whether it be formatting issues or just, you know, James Cameron signs off on something that's not totally finished yet. Sometimes they come out, you know, not what should be. Rather, you know, it comes out what they think it should be. So, yeah, it's, again... messy ground. I mean, I always think that every release that comes out that's approved by the director is good, but then, you know, a decade later they go, you know what, never mind, and they release like a, you know, better version of that. So yeah,
like George Lucas.
Yeah,
I mean, you're talking about you got it on the 4K release.
Yes.
I mean, well, that's all great that you've gone back to that color coding, right? But I mean, it's not HD DVD.
Oh yeah, so you have the pristine version of like the green tint, and it's like forever encapsulated in the HD DVD release. So you're good. You're good.
Yes. Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Excellent. Well, did you have any more, Zach?
I mean, I could talk about color timing all day, but let's move on. So,
oh, we're not going to do that.
Okay, sorry. Okay, let's move on because we're deep in this discussion already, and we haven't even started talking about the movie yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. Let's wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up.
Matrix Reloaded discussion, though. Here we go.
So Marcel, so why don't you tell us about why you love this series of movies so much here? Because you're talking to one person who's like, yeah, it's okay, and you're talking to another guy who's like, one third is good.
Oh, we're talking about the trilogy now, right?
Or even, like, let's start with this.
I love this movie. I think it's one of the greatest movies of all time.
I know.
So I'm on board with you there, Marcel. So sell Brandon on why you should love this movie more.
Okay, this one. The Matrix one. It's for me, the definition of a great movie is one you can watch over and over and get more out of it. And this is one for me. Like, I said it earlier, like, I saw it on DVD, loved it, you know, but I have like so many box sets of this trilogy and this movie, you know, and if they sell it in like VR or something, or if they want to jack it in your brain, I'll buy that version too. like every time I watch it, the first one, let's focus on the first one right now. Every time I watch it, I get something new out of it. I appreciate it more. Definition of a classic. And seeing it in a theater finally when I did about 10 years ago just sold me even more. That's when I knew, you know what? 5 out of 5, there's no beating it. And then even watching it again in a theater recently in Dolby Cinema, like, I don't know, like, I like grasping the themes of it or what I interpret. Like, we can talk about, you know, the trans allegory or what, you know, for sure we know is in it that people sometimes misread. But also what you bring to it, too, is interesting to me because I see it also as, like, an allegory for, like, visual effects. You know, I see it as, like, mm-hmm. you know, crossing that threshold of, like, for me, the 90s are dear to me in terms of action movies and practical effects. Like, something like Speed, speaking of Keanu Reeves, is a beautiful movie to me because it's a beautiful practical effect movie. But with The Matrix, you know, sometimes when I see it, I go, this, to me... It turns the page on practical effects to visual effects and what we can perceive in a movie. So that's also a beautiful thing about it too. Like, I can perceive things that maybe other people can't from this movie, but also what's in there and what's for sure we can interpret. You know what the director's intentions were and are in this movie. That's also beautiful too. So yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's my answer. I get so much out of it with every screening. And yeah, it's a movie that just keeps on giving.
Mm-hmm. See, it's gonna be interesting when I go through this here because, like, to me, this has always just been like a science fiction action film from my teenage years, right?
Like, you think in such three-dimensional terms, Brandon.
I do, yes. I mean, like, I've only recently heard about the discussions about the trans allegories and stuff like this. Like, I mean, I'm a cis heterosexual white male from Canada here, right? So, like, those have never really been issues in my mind. And I'm like, just, it's only within the last couple years of me jumping into social media and podcasting and stuff like this that I've been exposed to a lot of people talking about this kind of stuff. Like, literally for most of my life, this has just never been something that's been on my radar. So this is going to be the first time that I've watched them since I've heard this. And even watching it this time, nothing like that registered. And Zach's talking about it in the trivia where he's like, my name is Neo. I'm like, okay, well, there's something there. But I don't have that depth to the movie, you know? So it's always just been an action movie for me.
Well, I think that's why it works so well is because it's a blank canvas, but it's so layered at the same time. I don't know if that's I don't know if that's contradictory or not, right? But it's like you can bring so much of your life experience or anything into this. Like, even you talk about names, right? It's not just that. It could be like, you know, we think about runaway slaves, right? It's like they get their names. This is my name. Like, identity, right? Like, that's such an essential part of this whole thing. And it's such a tight script with so many layers and, like, life lessons about certain things. Like, you're right. It works perfectly well as a action sci-fi action movie. You're absolutely right, and it's amazing in itself. But if you want to go deeper with all this, there's a lot of stuff there you could sit around and chew on. Like, even the whole concept of, like, right. choice, right, which they really get into even further in the sequel, right? I mean, you think about, like, do they do a whole bait and switch with you with, like, are you the one, are you not, that kind of thing, right? But it's set up, you could think that's like a cheat where the Oracle tells Neo he's not the one, but then he is the one. Like, what was that all about, right? But that's set up perfectly in the scene because he knocks his vase over, right? And before he knocks the vase over, the Oracle's like, don't worry about that. He's like, worry about what? Oh, he knocks the vase over. And then she's like, the real thing you're going to be thinking about is if you still would have knocked it over if I wouldn't have told you. And that is what ties into him being the one. So anyway, even something like that, you can tell that they spent a lot of time and effort on the script because it's just like, and the 14 drafts or whatever, totally worth it because everything is so tight and so focused and nothing is wasted. Everything plays into something else. So to me, that's what elevates it beyond just run-of-the-mill sci-fi action movie. So, yeah.
And that's what's great about science fiction. I mean, like, we go into when we discuss Planet of the Apes, right? You could just watch this as, like, a science fiction film about a planet of monkeys and whatnot. But then you can all look into the deep, you know, racism issues and animal rights issues and, like, all these other layers that are on top of that film. And so, like, I don't have a problem with this interpretation is there and that people see this in it. And that's, I think it's great. I'm just like, this is all new to me and I'm just learning this here.
And I'll just say, like, you know, and just to make it clear, yes, they're credited as the Wachowski brothers, like, in the three films, but they transitioned. Like, they're Lana and Lily Wachowski now. And I really didn't you know, understand the trans allegory, having loved this movie for, you know, over 20 years, until fairly recently, in the last few years.
Okay.
So to me, it didn't stick out right away. Like, I'm not going to say that. But yeah, it's only in, you know, learning about the Wachowskis. And also, like, I mean, I didn't say this. I love everything they've done. Like, I love Speed Racer. I love Cloud Atlas. I love V for Vendetta. They wrote that.
Yeah, I was going to say V for Vendetta, undercover Wachowski film there, yeah.
yeah. And I think, you know, their overarching theme is love, which I love. Like, it's a beautiful concept that they're trying to push with every single movie they make. So, like, that was my first understanding of who they are and what they're trying to say is, like, that love message really rings true in The Matrix, for sure, the first one, and then also the entire trilogy. And then, you know, also, like, you know, just choice, like you mentioned, like, I should say this. When the sequels came out, I was in college taking philosophy classes, and then I picked up the Matrix trilogy box set, and they have, like, these documentaries about philosophy. They have commentaries with philosophers talking about what's, you know, what's going on underneath the surface. So that's another reason why, like, I love this trilogy, is because it opened up my mind to things I would not have thought of before. So all that was before, you know, realizing, oh, like, yeah, they're really trying to say something about identity and, you know, transitioning and who they really are as people. And, yeah, again, that didn't happen. That wasn't a light bulb in my head until fairly recently.
And also, that, like, I say now, like, it's so obvious, like, knowing what we know now. It's all hindsight for me as well. Like, you look back on it, like, oh, I understand. But at the time, that wasn't really on anybody's radar, especially in pop culture at that time for such a movie like this. So, but it's also just a classic hero's journey, too, right? It works perfectly as an origin story, right? I mean, as you said, Brandon, you're like, well, they're making sequels to this. You really could just end it. And, like, I was joking, like, maybe they should have stopped at one, but we'll see. I'm hoping to find some, rekindle some love for the sequels as we talk, but, like, it hits all those that's why we called it the Star Wars of our generation, right? Because it was the hero's journey, the Joseph Campbell thing, reinvented a new way for a new time, and with a new packaging on it, which was revolutionary. And, like you were saying, Brandon, like, it is kind of meta how it's, like, movies and technology and the film itself, like, it just works on so many levels, on such a high level, so well, that to me that's why it's so awesome.
Yeah, and going back to that topic about, you know, what an action movie, like, is, like, and like, as you were saying, like, it's, you know, it's an action movie. It works so well as an action movie, just on its own. Like, it's perfect. And the Wachowskis are famous for not really talking about these movies at all. Like, in the special features of the box set, and even on the iTunes version, which I was scrolling through today, all they have in terms of, like, commentary in quotes is, like, a written out essay kind of, like, explaining, you know, somewhat of, like, what they were going for in The Matrix and in The Matrix trilogy. And they quote an article from the New York Times saying blockbusters should be loud and say nothing. That's what the New York Times said in an article. So they took that idea and they said, what if blockbusters said something? What if they, you know, what if there's, like, some thought into what blockbusters say? And that was their, like, main, that was, like, the impetus of writing The Matrix, was, like, let's have it say something. And I love that. Hey, when I saw this for the first time, I just thought of it as, like, a great action movie. But yeah, it certainly does say something, which I fully appreciate. And I love any blockbuster that says anything. I mean, listen to us talk about Halloween Kills. Like, yeah, it says something. I appreciate it for that. With time, I fully appreciate that these movies say something, and that's why I love them. Because, like, even nowadays, blockbusters don't say much, and when they do say something, I listen.
Mm-hmm. I want to point out something to you, Marcel. I don't know if it's on your 4K versions that you've got, but do they have the in-movie experience?
I don't think they have it on the they might have it on the 4K. They don't have it on the iTunes version, I don't think.
You should check on the 4K, because on the HD DVD, they've got the in-movie experience, and there is actually a lot of video interview with the Wachowskis in, like, that pop up in the in-movie experience. But yeah, so I know that they don't they're not very public and they don't really talk a lot. And I, you know, those essays are on the HD DVD versions, right? But it's like when this In Movie Experience popped up and there's like a lot of interviews with them, I'm like, oh, this is surprising.
I think for sure they were more vocal in the beginning, in like the first Matrix, but afterwards, and they even make a joke about it in that essay, they say like Warner Brothers publicity is asking us to make a commentary, and so we gave them an essay and said, hey, instead of us doing a commentary, how about asking philosophers to make a commentary, and also film critics who hate the movies to make a commentary.
I respect that. Like, I really respect that. It's like, you know what, you hated it, talk about it. Like, that is having some thick skin and also confidence in your own art to invite people to come criticize it. Like, I've always respected that they did that with the films. So, but hey, we got to talk about Keanu Reeves. Is he not perfect in this?
I rewatching it today, I'm like, yes, this is my favorite Keanu Reeves role. Because it utilizes him, and I'm a huge Keanu Reeves fan, so don't take this as an offense, okay? I think this movie utilizes his inherent blandness at times.
And confusion.
But then, like, when he reacts to anything, like, I'm watching the movie in the background on mute again, you know, just because. Like, when he's fighting Morpheus for the first time, and he reacts. He realizes, like, at first, oh, like, this is a real fight, and oh, like, I'm losing. And then he realizes, oh, I can fight back, and I'm just as good. Like, he sells that. Like, he is a great action actor in terms of, like, physically involved and also emotionally, you know, in his face reacting to, you know, action. So, oh, he's perfectly utilized in this franchise and in the first movie. Like, and any complaint about him being like a bad actor, I refuse to take, because his persona is that, very much sort of like Nicolas Cage. If you don't get Nicolas Cage, if you don't get Keanu Reeves, then I don't know. It's hard to buy them in anything if you don't initially get them as performers. So I think he's in the same realm as like a Nicolas Cage, where if you don't get him at the get go, you're not gonna vibe with what he's bringing to these movies.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty fair way to put it, because I'm not the biggest Keanu Reeves fan. Like, I just don't get him. But I mean, I think he's fine in these movies. But I don't know. I just don't understand the love for Keanu Reeves. Like, you call him bland, like, that is the thing. And I'm like, yeah, that's him. And, like, you're saying it as, like, a positive. And I'm like, he's just bland.
I think for me, it starts with a blandness. Like, it's like he can't control how, like, aggressively normal he is at times. But also, he's fascinating to watch, too. Like, it's very hard for me to really capture the words. I can't really say why he's such a great actor in my eyes, but he is. Like, everything he does in this movie especially works for me, and he's like the perfect Neo. I can't see a Will Smith character. I can't see a Will Smith playing this character and adding his own charisma to it, because this charisma that Keanu Reeves brings to Neo, it's inherently his own. Like, I can't separate the two now.
Yeah, I mean, just think about the completion of his hero's journey at the end when he becomes the one, right? And how he just blankly expressions, you know, is fighting Agent Smith, like, with no emotion.
Yeah,
it's just so perfect for him. Like, but that's perfect. Like, that's just incredible. Yeah. Like, it's so effortless, and there's nothing going on other than these motions. And if, like, that is exactly what it is called for. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I cannot think of a more perfect casting than Keanu Reeves as Neo in this film. So it's just well done utilization.
It's again, like, if a Will Smith type were to do it, he, you know, for lack of a better word, would like ham it up and like kind of like play into it as
and
like
Keanu
a joke.
Can't do that. If he wanted to, he couldn't do it. So, I mean, yes, no. Brandon, he is miscast in Bram Stoker's Dracula. I will give you that, right? But this is the other end of that spectrum.
I love him in Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Are you
Dracula.
Serious right now? Okay, no, I never know with you.
I mean, the biggest loss of not having Will Smith in this is that we didn't get the song "The Wild Wild Man."
There it is.
Like, you know what?
Seriously.
Yeah.
But everybody, like he's perfect. Hugo Weaving was, I mean, this was his big, you know, coming out party to the world, and everybody cast him and everything after this. I mean, he's fantastic. Agent Smith to me is literally a top 10 movie villain, and it just the way he is so just robotic and stuff to a degree, but you can tell there's something else going on. But then he has his own agenda, you know, like he wants, like the fact that he hates the Matrix and wants to get out is so interesting. And of course the voice and his presence, like he's just fantastic to me.
Yeah, I like Hugo Weaving in the role. I mean, like, there was a joke that he made in an interview once where he's like, at this time, he's like, I only do trilogies now. he was in this and Lord of the Rings at the same time. But I like the Walter Cronkite voice for it because I think it is perfect for the character.
Yeah, to me, like, he's perfect in the role. I think it's a perfect precursor to the sequels where I think he's even better in, like, 2 and 3, especially 3. I think he's amazing in Revolution.
I don't love the sequels, but I love him in them. Like, he is definitely, if nothing else about them, go see them for Agent Smith and Hugo Weaving, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, before watching the sequels and rewatching the first one over and over, like, that soliloquy he gives about, you know, humans being a virus and, like, wanting to get out of there, like, that
human beings
is,
or a disease.
Yeah. It's exquisite. Like, honestly, you know, speaking of Oscars, he should have got one for that.
Should have been nominated, for real. Like, I definitely think so. So,
yeah.
And when he's like rubbing Morpheus and he's like, you stink. Yeah. Like, just, you know, like, I don't know. Like, I he's the best part. Him and Morpheus are my two favorite parts of the trilogy, right? Like, I think those two characters are the best characters in it. And those two actors do the best.
Lawrence Fishburne is just, he is so dialed in. Right. And every, like, he is Morpheus. Like, there's so much going on with him in every scene. And he is acting every moment he is on screen. He's fantastic in this.
God, yeah.
I know him. Like, my first exposure to Lawrence Fishburne was What's Love Got to Do with This, right? So, I mean, like, you know, and I'd seen that before, you know, going back to my Tina Turner love, right? When we talked about Thunderdome, right? Like, to watch this movie after having seen somebody in a role that I just hated the character so much, you know, it was kind of an interesting transition, but it's like, that's just his talent and that's his diversity that he can play, you know, such a terrible character and then like such a wonderful character in these ones.
Yeah. His performance here is amazing. And again, you know, just to highlight how great the sequels are, like his arc over the three movies it's heartbreaking. Especially in the second one when, you know, not to jump into that one, but like, moments of pure heartbreak from him, like looking up in the sky and like seeing, you know, his beautiful ship being destroyed, you know, heartbreaking. And here being, you know, the mentor, the guy giving you all this exposition, the guy telling you, hey, the world is destroyed because of robots. Like, he's working on so many levels in terms of like delivering, you know, story, but also just being the heart of the movie. Like, you know, these characters are going all on a mission to save the world because of Morpheus. Like, he's the one saving people. And you buy it. If you don't buy Morpheus in this, if you don't buy the actor in the role, then, you know, throw the whole movie out. Because he is really the catalyst. He's really driving things in the background. He's really, it's why, you know, Joey Pants turns on everybody because of that hate.
He doesn't believe in Morpheus. Yeah, Pants, right? Everybody forgets about him. It's funny. You have this whole crew of the Nebuchadnezzar who are like, obviously they all get killed off and stuff. And you forget because of the sequels. It's just like the main threes, the Trinity, no pun intended, but of Trinity, Neo, and Morpheus. There's a whole crew of people here, and I totally think that there would be a guy like Cypher, like a guy like that would totally exist. Like, this sucks. Like, you lied to us. Yeah. I hate this. Plug me back in. So I totally buy that plot line.
Honestly, I'll say this. Like, maybe the one fault of the trilogies, of the sequels later on is not having a character as like dynamic as like Cypher and Joey Pantoliano. Mm-hmm. Because like he gives like the movie here in the first one, like this, like, realism of like, hey, somebody does not want to be involved here. He didn't sign up for this.
Yeah,
it's like you can see yourself through that character and say, yeah, I would rather not, like, you know, eat gruel every day and like kind of suffer in the real world.
He's a bad guy, but you totally, he makes some valid points. When he's talking about the Trinity at the end, he's like, he lied to us, you know, like, eat this crap every day and hate being cold and hate all this. So that's a great point. That grounded character does add a lot to everything.
Yeah. And yeah, we don't see that kind of character in the sequels, which is unfortunate, but yeah, it works in this one. And yeah, I love I love Joe Pantoliano, and I love that he's like a staple in the Wachowski filmography. I love him in Bound, and I've yet to see Sense 8, which he's also in. But yeah, I love that he's so beloved by the Wachowskis.
Yeah, and hey, mm-hmm. Joey Pants and Carrie Ann Moss, both in Memento.
That's
before
right.
this. So it's hashtag it's all connected. Or I guess, what, Memento after this? What, Memento was, I guess, 2000?
Oh, Memento was 2000.
Okay, like, right. Right, yeah, after but, this, but.
Yeah.
Carrie Ann Moss is fantastic in this. Like, she is, top five action heroine in anything. Like, fantastic. The kick is iconic. The Trinity kick, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Karate Kid kick.
Yeah. It's an illegal move.
what I love about Carrie Ann Moss is, well, first off, I think great actress. I think she, again, I'm not trying to be mean here, but I think she is like an equal with Keanu in terms of like personality. I can see why these two would be together. Mm-hmm. Like they're not. It's like maybe this is me reading too much into it. But they're almost like identical in terms of personality and like almost like also like physical appearance.
Yeah, I think it really shows the roof fight with the agent, you know?
Yeah.
Where it's
yeah,
like, yeah. How did you do that? What? I've never seen anyone do that before. But I rewatching it this time, I got what you're saying. Like it's that same energy they're bouncing off or lack thereof, bouncing off each other, right?
Yeah. And you know, I wouldn't be surprised. Actually, you know, I'm sure it must be intentional, you know, this sort of androgynous. Actually, I'm pretty sure it has to be intentional, this androgynous feel of Trinity. Because in the beginning of the movie, when Neo meets Trinity, Neo goes, what? Like, hey, I thought you were a guy. It's like, no. Well, you know, most guys do.
It's all there in hindsight, guys. It's all there. Yeah. But that also works as another commentary on guys underestimating women. Like, it works on so many levels, allegory. Right, so. Right. But no, I totally see what you're saying with Trinity as well. And the whole, that's a great point. Like, knowing, like, believing that the two of them would be together. Like, a lot of these, like, love stories and action movies are so like, okay, well, I guess there's the male lead and the female lead. That's what they're going to do in these action movies, right? That was the tradition, the cliche, right? But here, like, I buy the fact that, you know, when she tells him, like, the Oracle told me I was gonna fall in love with the one and it's you, and so get up, and I'm like, yeah, that's good. And rewatching it this time, I kind of missed this before, it's been a while since I rewatched it, but they established that she has been watching him for a long time, you know, like in the Matrix, and that's falling in love with him over all this time is what kind of buys the accelerated romance that we see so often in action movies where they set that up, like Cypher and her talking like, oh, you like him, don't you? Always watch him, want an extra shift. And okay, all right. They set up all this stuff, which again, a very, very tight script.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, that's another thing too. Like, Carrie Ann Moss, like, that relationship doesn't quite
work.
Brandon,
I just explained why it works so well. What is
I know, I heard you, but I gotta tell you that it's like, I don't love this movie. I think it's good. I just don't love this movie.
Why do you hate The Matrix, Brandon? So, that's what I ask you, sir.
I don't hate The Matrix. I mean, the first time I saw it, I did. But I mean, like, it grew on me. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. They don't work. Like, I don't feel their chemistry there.
But there is no chemistry. That's what we're saying.
Exactly. I think it's
you're telling me that, like, this means this makes this such a great love story because they don't have chemistry? Like,
it's unique.
It makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's unique, and like I see your point, Brandon, but like I think their actions speak louder than the chemistry. Like, if it wasn't for this goes to how the climax of the movie like plays out. If it's not like for the actions they do, and also, oh my gosh, see, I'm loving this movie more and more now that I speak this out. The act of like Neo saving Trinity from that helicopter crash. That to me is a beautiful moment. It exemplifies love right there. And then at the end, when Trinity kisses Neo and brings him back to life, again, another act of love. If it wasn't for those acts, I could kind of see your point. But because of that, I admit the chemistry really isn't as strong as maybe it should be. Because of those acts, I totally buy them as a couple and I see why they should be together. And then that's just the first movie. You know, second and third movie. Even more so, I'd say, you know, the actions they do for each other, that to me is why this relationship works.
It's like a fairy tale, Brandon. She kisses him, he comes back to life. It's classic.
It works.
Stuff.
I don't mind fairy tales. I mean, I just watched Fanny and Alexander today, right? Like, I mean, like, talk about a fairy tale, right, with, like, weird things happening in it. It's okay to have weird things going on in a movie that just don't have explanation, right? You know what I'm talking about, Marcello, right? Like, with the throw the kids in the thing and then they're upstairs. Like, you know, it's a complete and total fairy tale.
But... sure.
So, anyways. Okay, what else? Where else should we go on this? What else should we talk about, Marcello?
Oh boy, you're going to me. I mean,
because you love this thing.
I do.
I mean, like, I love hearing your passion.
Okay,
for it. I really do.
How about this? I want to talk about that climax because I think this is something I was thinking more about on this rewatch today. Like for me, I think the most perfect action climax in any movie is the last 30 minutes of Die Hard. Like that. To me, is perfection. Like the way it's edited, the way it's scored, the way it's shot, all of it perfect. I think.
I don't think either of us have seen Die Hard.
That's what correct. I know we're unqualified to talk about movies. Yes.
Wait, are you guys pulling my chain?
No.
What's?
No, I have. No. I have not seen Die Hard.
Okay. So. Well, this is. You guys know I dedicated a good amount of my life to Die Hard, right? The movie. We'll talk about this later, but I love Die Hard, and I have the receipts. But you guys should see it; it's a good movie.
I've got the 5-disc Blu-ray for when we cover it for this. I got the. I'm ready to go.
And I'll give you the heads up. You know, you can invite me for the first one at least, and I can talk more about Die Hard if you want. You know, I'm not going to pressure that. I'm not going to put pressure on you for that. Anyway, Die Hard action sequence, final 30 minutes, perfection. Okay, this to me. is like a close second. Those final like 30, 40 minutes of this movie from the gunfights.
Weed guns. You know, lots of guns. From that moment to the end.
From that to the end, perfection. It's edited, it's sequenced, it's acted, all of it is perfect. Like from that point onward, if you had any doubts, this is a great movie, one of the best movies of all time. After those 40 minutes, there should be no doubt in your mind that this is one of the greatest movies of all time.
Films that they deliver on the action visceral level, but fail on the emotional level, or vice versa, and this one does both.
Exactly, yeah. I was going to say, like, what ties it really at the end is what I said earlier. It's like that moment of Trinity kissing Neo, and it's super corny on the face of it. It's super cheesy. You know, and it's even shot in a very, I don't want to say ham-fisted, but like there are sparks behind them as they kiss.
Literal sparks, you know, fly, yeah.
Literal sparks. But I buy it because you had me like in your hand for the last 30 minutes. Of course I'm going to buy this ridiculous moment where somebody kisses somebody and brings them back to life so they can, you know, inhabit the body of an agent and make them explode. Like, whatever ridiculousness you see on the face of it is gone because you're just so invested with these characters because everything you've seen up to this point is perfect in terms of editing, in terms of, you know, acting, choreography. Again, like, it's perfection. What else can I say?
And it pays off. Like, you've seen how threatening the agents are. The whole film, like no one's ever defeated an agent. You run, you know, and Neo starts to fight him. And even, you know, before he's the one, he's just like normal guy Neo or whatever, like he's holding his own better than most, but it's still not enough. Right. And so then you can tell he overcomes the obstacles that have been well established. And also you have the ticking clock of like the Sentinels coming in and carving up the ship during all this. Right. Yeah. So it's not, they're all just not there watching passively. They're like, we got to get this done because we're about to all get blown up. So they establish those stakes early with the EMP. So I don't know. I'd probably say Terminator 2 is the greatest action climax of all time, but yeah, these are both top five. I'm right there with you.
I like that you made something a little more clear for me, Zach, when you're talking about it, when you're like, what really is going to pick your noodle is, would you still have done it if I hadn't told you? Tying that into the, no, you're not the one, and he actually is the one, you know? So, like, this discussion is like, added a layer to the here that I never caught before.
And it's not, you know, the Oracle says, you're going to die, or Morpheus is, you have to make a choice. And it's not some cheat where they don't both die. No, Neo dies, you know? But because this is 21st century Jesus, he's resurrected. I'll talk about the Christian allegories all over the place. You got Judas in here. You got John the Baptist as Morpheus. So much going on, right? But I like that they didn't like cheat out of that. He literally did die. So like everything the Oracle says is true. You know?
Yeah, but that's the thing. See, and one thing I caught on again watching it now today is that, you know, the illusion of choice and Neo saying, okay, I see, you know, me dying or Morpheus dying. And he goes, screw it. I'm going to go my own path. I'm going to try to save both of us. And I love that because that becomes something else that the sequels tackle too. But you see it here. Like possibly done better here than the sequels. But, you know, that's really
it is his character trait, right? To try to defeat fate or defeat choice.
And I love that here because, again, it goes into other themes of the movie that are in there that, you know, I wish I were more educated to discuss, you know, going back to the trans allegory of like, hey, you have two choices here. That's all you got. That, you know, come on, pick one. And, you know, somebody says, you know what? Screw that. I'll go my own different way. And that plays into the final speech that Neo gives to, you know, on the phone to, like, you know, the Matrix. He's like, you know, I'm gonna give you a choice, and it's up to you to you know, with regards to what happens next. So he's giving them a choice. See, it's all about choices here.
Okay, so this movie's a lot deeper than I saw before.
Take the red pill, Brendan.
That's right. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I hate that that's become a thing with people who I say primarily do not understand the meaning of that, and they just say, hey, have you been red-pilled?
That's how you know the Matrix is such an important part of our culture, when people misinterpret it to use it for their own purposes. That's when you know you've made it.
Yeah, so there you go.
But so many quotable lines in here, right? There is no spoon, right? Mr. Anderson, right? I mean, like, it's like you could say the whole phone call and unable to speak thing so much. I give you the finger, and you give me my phone call. I guess, I don't know, maybe just me and my struggle friends, but this is such a re-quotable movie. You know, I know Kung Fu, you know? I mean, like, so much stuff. Also, side note, so cool that you can just download information. Like, I wish the real world worked that way. Like, I know how to fly a helicopter now. Like, you immediately explain, like, how can all these people do this? This is why. So cool. So smart.
It's thinking about that more. Like, I mean, really, we're not far from that. Like, how easy is it for, like, somebody like me to, like, I did this semi-recently where, like, something broke in my dryer, and I Googled, I looked up a YouTube video of, like, how to fix it, and I basically downloaded the information into my brain just through a YouTube video, so we're practically already there, and this was ahead of its game in 99.
Oh, yeah, I hate to tell you guys that 1999 was the pinnacle of our civilization, so it's really all downhill from there, by the way.
Makes sense.
Your civilization.
I mean, we got The Matrix and we got Phantom Menace. So. 1999.
Well, we sold you, Brandon?
No. Like, my rating of Halloween Kills went up after our discussion, but my rating of Matrix is not.
No.
So.
Fair enough. Yes. We tried our best. So. Well, any final thoughts then, Brandon, before you wrap it up? Poor Marcello.
I would say that I'll probably enjoy this more upon watches. You know, we're probably going to watch them again, you know, leading up to the final film, right?
Final film?
We're going to watch them one more time. Number four, the new film, let me rephrase that. We'll probably watch them again, probably watch them with Aubrey. You know, I know Marcy, my wife, wants to watch them all again before we go to see the last one in theaters here in December, coming up fast. But yeah, I mean, I guess every time I've watched it, I've enjoyed it more. So maybe I just need to see it another, many times Marcel has seen it in the last 20 years, right?
Oh boy.
Maybe I just need to see it another 100 times.
I wouldn't say 100. I actually don't know how many times I've seen this overall, but, I mean, I'll just say, again, just to reiterate, this is one of the greatest films ever made. It's honestly something, it's a movie that speaks to me more and more as I watch it. And yeah, I love the Wachowskis. I love, again, going back to that theme of love. It's like the most basic theme I could like stamp on every film of theirs I've seen. Even Speed Racer is about like love. Yeah. There, Cloud Atlas, V for Vendetta, Bound, like and it speaks to me here, and in the sequels too. that's what really will, you know, bring us together as a society is like love. Like, and if we don't have that, we got nothing. We got, you know, Agent Smith, you know, in Matrix 3, you know. that's my final thought. Like, it's a film, it's a blockbuster that says something, and I totally appreciate it for that, and it stands the test of time.
I love V for Vendetta, but the only movies that I've seen directed by them are the Matrix movies. That's all I've seen that they've
You directed. Must see Speed Racer, at least.
I remember when that came out, and I did not see a lot of positive reviews that film.
Tell you, just following it's one of those movies, Speed Racer, not to do a full tangent, but it's one of those movies that, yeah, initial release, not really lighting, you know, it didn't really, you know, set the world on fire, right? But now, several years later, there's been this whole cult following, you could say.
It's found its audience really, in later years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I've loved it since the start, Speed Racer, but now looking at it, looking at the reactions over the years, people coming around to it, I love that it's now being held up as, like, you know, a great movie that is in line with, like, the rest of the Wachowskis' filmography.
I'm a big Scott Porter fan from Friday Night Lights, so I need to revisit Speed Racer since he's a star in that, so...
What was our rating out of 5? Like, so I know Marcel's 5. I know you're 5. What is it out
before,
of 5?
Before
what?
We get there, Brandon, I have a very important question.
I know.
To ask
we've
you.
Already talked about the ratings, though. Let's do the ratings first because I'll do mine. We already know your guys' 5-star film. So we're
well out of far. Out of 5 red pills. How many red pills would you give the Matrix?
Anyway, so you guys are giving it 5 out of 5, both of you. I give it 4. So I give it 4.
If you were giving halves, would you give it a 4.5? That's the real question these days.
No, I would probably give it a 3.5.
Whoa!
Yeah, I would probably give it a 3.
Hell?
We have not done our job, Marcel. I don't know what we've done wrong. I think we both made very passionate cases for this film, and this guy's over here. Yeah. 3.5.
I don't know what I can say at this point. I don't know what I can say. Oh my god!
You just got to say. You got to do the normal Twitter responses. I don't know what movie you watched, but I watched.
You're wrong.
Or you're wrong. Or maybe you should watch it again.
Or I'll just block you on Twitter.
That's the more appropriate. I'll say this for 5 out of 5 for me, like 5 red pills out of 5 red pills. Not only is it like a reinterpreted hero's journey for a new, you know, the digital age, right? I mean, the internet was in its infancy for the general population. Then we still had dial up back then, right? So it was just computers and all that, right? But, you know, it changed the game just as far as movie. That's why it was the new Star Wars, not just because it was like a trilogy and stuff, but like special effects, like you're talking about, Marcelo, turning the page. That's such a great way to say it, because it's just how many shows and movies copied this over and over and over again, and probably still are, right? People, they say, like, it's the Matrix meets Jurassic Park or something. They're trying to sell new things. I don't know. That's an excellent crossover, by the way. But all that, you know, the outside of the movie, just the reach is just incalculable. And then inside the movie, it's just such a well-constructed story that makes you feel on all the levels. Mm. And also, it's, again, there's so many layers there. There's so many valid interpretations of what this is. There's really not, like, a wrong... You know, like, well, you're watching it the wrong way, right? I mean, not that there is on any movie, really, because movies are, you know, it's a symbiotic thing, right? You know, but I just think it's so fascinating that you could get 10 people in a room and probably get 10 different conversations about what they connected with or saw here or there. And so 5 out of 5. We've said all we can, Marcel. There's no helping Brandon at this point.
I mean, it's fine. Again, I'm still just... after this recording, I'm just going to keep thinking. I'm going to stay up at night just thinking, what could I have said? What sequence of words could I have said to push it to 5 out of 5? I don't know.
Yeah. I still think I might have liked it a bit more if it was Jack Nicholson.
I don't understand that reference. Why Jack Nicholson?
It's just the weirdest thing.
He turned down Neo to appear in As Good As It Gets, actually. I forgot that in the trivia. So the wolf. Wolf. That's got to be the most random Jack Nicholson movie. Wolf. Oh, man. Okay, well, I've got a question for y'all.
Yes.
Well, what is the bullet time count for this movie? Which means how many times do they use the bullet time effect?
So the bullet time effect is just when they like go into like some weird slow motion.
It's not traditional slow motion, but it's like, you know, like super slow or kind of a 360 pan around. What do you guys think?
6?
Yeah, my guess was going to be 5.
Okay, so and maybe a couple of these don't count, so you can help me out. I came up with 9, but a couple of these might not be bullet time per se. So one is Trinity's kick at the beginning. I felt like there were 2 of them in the Neo Morpheus fight.
I see.
With the high leaps, because I feel like that's kind of Zack Snyder-esque effect.
Although,
if
it's the shot I'm thinking of, like, he's doing the high leap, but does the camera, go around?
Yeah,
see,
that's
the thing.
It's all one plane, so I'm thinking maybe those don't count after all. Okay, so we'll put a fit in those. The lobby shootout, the very first shot of the cop, I feel like that was... But I guess it was one plane. I guess if we're saying this is good, it's good to establish this here in the first film.
See, that's that. When I think bullet time, I think going around, going all 3 dimensions there.
Okay, gotcha. So those are out. The 5th one I have, and I'll do a recount at the end here. The 5th one I have is when the elevator exploded. I know it was all CG, but I felt like they did kind of do a pan around with the doors flying off. But that's
It was just pulling out. It wasn't back and forth. It was just
so that leaves us with 1 so far. But actually, yeah, then that does bring us to 5 then, because 2 would be Neo on the roof, obviously the most famous bullet time effect. Yes. When not fast enough. And then when Morpheus gets shot in the leg when he's running out to catch the helicopter.
That one's 1. Yes.
So that brings us to 3. And then of course when Neo and Smith run into each other and shoot the bullets at each other in the subway.
Yes.
That's 4. And then finally, when Neo stops the bullets in the hallway, that is literal bullet time. Although it's not.
It's not. The camera doesn't go around, so.
But there's bullets in it.
There's bullets and there's time.
I think that still counts. I'll give you guys all those other ones. But what do you.
Okay, so then, but based on that, then there would be 2. Like, I don't know. Like, so, like, when you said that, my thought is just the weird special effects. So, like, when Smith starts punching him and you get all those crazy arms. Like, I would have considered that. Yeah. Right? And then when
it's like
Neo's
double exposure stuff,
But. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right. If we're changing the plane is the rule, which perhaps should be the rule, then that brings us to 4 then.
Okay,
in total.
4.
So, 4. Trinity's kick, Neo on the roof, dodging the bullets, the first clash of Neo and Smith in the subway when they run into each other, and Morpheus getting shot in the leg when he's running out to the helicopter.
Yes.
Okay. So 4.
Yes.
Bullet time count is 4. This is I'm glad we established these rules here because the sequels is going to get really crazy. So.
Yeah.
Yes.
The special effect budget goes up. Excellent. So there you have it.
Right on. Well, I've got a question for you guys.
What's that?
Oh.
Do you feel at this point that this franchise is fatigued, Marcelo?
Ooh, at this point, 1 movie in?
After 1 film, 1 movie in. Like, 1 movie in.
See, I'm going to be, and kind of to what you said, I think, earlier, way in the beginning of this conversation, Brandon, is like, hey, after 1 movie, like, do we really need a sequel to The Matrix?
Mm-hmm.
I think, as a society, we would have been okay without The Matrix sequels, because I think the first one holds up really well. It does not leave you hanging, really. It leaves the door open, right? But I can, back when I first saw it, before the prequels, I was very much content with, like, having, the journey of Neo and the rest of the Matrix, in my head, that just visualizing what that could have been, But, hey, when they announced the sequels, I'm like, perfect. Let's go for it. Mm-hmm. I'm eager to see more from the Wachowskis and and Neo's journey. So I don't think it's fatigued at all, for as much as I want to say we didn't need those sequels. But no, I don't think it's fatigued at all.
Okay. Zach?
Yeah, it's tough because you got to say you don't know what's coming, right? Like, knowing what was coming, I'd be like, I don't know if I really like the direction they took. But it's like, no, if you told me what you did, like in 2000, they're coming out with 2 more of these, I'm like, that's fantastic. I can't wait, right? So you have to say it's not fatigued,
Then I would probably have to say no as well, because I think hearing that there was 2 more coming is the reason that I revisited the film and began to appreciate it more. So I'm going to say no as well. So
all right, no's all around. Can't wait for the Matrix 2.
Matrix 2.
Another 5 out of 5. Warrior. Oops.
Yes. Marcelo, thank you so much for joining us. It was wonderful listening to you and listening to your passion for this film.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing makes me happier than hearing a different opinion than my own. and I loved your love for this film. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be on here. I'm glad we made this work because you guys saw this is a movie I definitely love and a franchise I love. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Why don't you tell listeners where they can find you and any projects that you're working on now?
They can go over to talkfilmsociety.com. They can go listen to the many podcasts we have over there. Currently, I have the Mothership, the Talk Film Society podcast. Check out those episodes. I also have a Nice Apocalypse, a series in which we tackle the films of Richard Kelly and the film Southland Tales. And yeah, there's plenty of other podcasts over there that are fantastic. Monsters Never Die, Igniting the Spark, Sequels, that's another great one. But yeah, check all those out at talkfilmsociety.com. Oh, and also, if you want to support us, patreon.com/talkfilmsociety. That's it.
So while you're on here, the reason I got introduced to you as a podcaster is because of Soderbergh 2828, and I loved your guys' podcast over there. And my wife and I watched No Sudden Move together. She didn't like the movie. I thought it was great. She didn't like it. But you guys were talking about that really bizarre, distortion effect to the camera.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Like, that you were talking about. And my wife, when she was watching, she's like, what's going on here? And I'm like, I also thought there was something wrong with the aspect ratio on my TV. But she brought it up that she's like, you know what it makes me think of is this takes place in the 50s. It looks like what you would see on a TV in the 50s that are like had those rounded tubes, right?
Yeah.
On the edges and stuff. So that's what she thought it looked like.
I actually love that interpretation. Like, yeah. I did not think of that before. I just think, as a Soderbergh fan, he's my favorite filmmaker. Like, I just found it to be like another experimental approach. He had like choosing a lens that would warp the sides of the frames. But that, I love that way of looking at it because again, I never would have thought of that. So I love that point of view.
Excellent, right on, Zach. Where can people find you when you're not trying to get a free steak?
You can find me personally on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreOnZach. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. Smallville owes a lot to The Matrix with Bullet Time because their entire special effects package is based off this, by the way. So that's another feather in The Matrix's cap as far as I'm concerned. Also, of course, on the United Federation podcast, I host Franchise Fatigue here. Also, I'm here on the United Federation of Podcasts, in addition to this show, hosting Sasswatch, a Bigfoot multimedia podcast with Ken Tripp. So check us out at SasswatchPod on Twitter.
Excellent. Right on. And when I'm not trying to pick up the phone, you can find me here on the network with another show called Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek. We have a lot of fun over there talking about Lower Decks, Discovery, the upcoming Prodigy show, the upcoming Strange New Worlds show. It's going to be great. And then my other podcast is called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, where my friends Chris and Tom and I cover all of Hitch's films in chronological order. Thank you so much to Ken Tripp and Tony Robinson for being executive producers of the network. Thank you so much to Zach Tripp for creating our wonderful theme music. And thank you to our associate producers, David Willett and Casey Pettit. Thank you so much for supporting our show and the network the network on a whole. We got lots of great shows on the network, but check us out on patreon.com/UFPEarth. For $5 a month, Zach and I provide you an audio commentary on a Star Trek episode. Until next time, when we revisit The Matrix with The Matrix Reloaded, there is no spoon.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.